TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. The peak of world oil production, Thanksgiving Day, 2005. Ken DeFace is perhaps best known as the guide and mentor in John McPhee's series of popular books on geology. DeFace's research has gone from basin and range sediments to the floor of the deep sea to unimaginable events in the mantle. He has been a geological engineer, a chemical oceanographer, and a sedimentary geologist. Born in the middle of an Oklahoma City oil field, Ken DeFace has spent a lifetime in the oil business and the academic study of petroleum. He is professor emeritus at Princeton University, where he has taught geology. At Shell, he was a colleague of M. King Hubbard, who was the first to predict that a peak in oil production was even possible. After his retirement from Princeton in 1998, Ken DeFace published two books on the subject of peak oil, Hubbard's Peak and Beyond Oil. Hubbard's Peak is the point on the bell-shaped curve that marks the apex of oil production, and oil supply rapidly drops from there. DeFace says that the methods that King Hubbard used to accurately predict the peak of United States oil production for the early 1970s can now be applied to world production. In his book Beyond Oil, Ken DeFace wrote that, quote, "It is my opinion that the peak will occur in late 2005, and he nominated Thanksgiving 2005 as his world oil peak day, wherein, quote, we can pause and give thanks for the good years of abundance and face up to the coming decline of this life force fuel, end quote. The California Institute of Technology in Pasadena invited Ken DeFace to talk about his theory of peak oil 1 week after Thanksgiving 2005. Here is Professor Ken DeFace giving the Lauridsen Memorial Lecture on December 1st, 2005.
I appreciate the invitation to visit Caltech. I've met friends that I've known for almost 50 years, like Jerry Wasserberg, and had dinner with Blacker College or Blacker House, which was where my brother had been a student as a chemical engineer here in the 1950s. The peak of world oil production is happening right now, and I'll try to convince you that right now means literally. It wasn't Thanksgiving Day exactly. It's Thanksgiving Day plus or minus 3 weeks as the time when world oil production peaks. Now, my first book in 2001 contained this diagram repeated from M. King Hubbard's 1956 paper. And in 1956, Hubbard predicted that United States oil production would peak sometime in the early 1970s. And the little dots show that 1970 itself was the peak year. And about 1975, Prudhoe Bay starts to kick in. But Prudhoe Bay, Alaska, as the biggest oil field ever found in the United States, wasn't big enough to bring us back up to the year 1970 peak. Now, we knew this was correct. Those dots could have staggered on upwards. But in 1972, the Texas Railroad Commission announced 100% allowable for the next month. And there was a little tiny story in the newspaper, you know, that said this. But, of course, if you knew how to translate it, it meant we're out of unused production capacity in the United States. We're dependent on imports. And I went home and told my family, old Hubbard was right. We're in the soup now. The U.S. has no unused production capacity. The second book goes on because Hubbard in 1982, when he was 79 years old, at the stage I now call mid-career, he published a long paper, 150 pages, describing his methods. And before it was kind of take it or leave it. He'd give you the answer, and you had to try to figure out whether he had a legitimate way of getting there. But in this last long paper that he wrote, he used this kind of graph. On the vertical axis is the annual production divided by the cumulative production. And on the horizontal axis is the cumulative production. And after 1958, the U.S. oil production settles down to a pretty good straight line. Now, I'm using the U.S. not out of patriotism, but because the U.S. is the most explored area in the world. Someday Iran will look like Kansas, with dry holes so close together you can't put another major oil field in between them. And the analogy is to catching fish in a pond. If I go to my favorite pond and I catch fish and cook the bass for supper, but after a few months I notice I'm not catching as many fish. Now, I can go to the fishing tackle store and buy a very expensive fly rod and, you know, new technology, or I can decide, look, I've caught most of the fish. I'm going to go to the grocery store and buy fish. Now, Hubbard took a shot at world oil production, and this is 1968 that he published this. His more optimistic estimate peaks in the year 2000, and it's 2,100 billion barrels. My latest take says, well, it's 2005, and it's 2013 billion barrels. Now, his critics say, look, 2000 came and went, and it didn't peak. Now, Hubbard is wrong, you know. Well, you see, look, from 1968, this is pretty good shooting to get to within 5 years and within 5% of the right answer. If I go on and make the same graph for world oil production, after 1983, it begins to behave like a nice straight line. And it was on an enlarged version of that graph, where I counted out how far the years were apart, that I got the Thanksgiving Day 2005 prediction. And the uncertainty really is not very large. Now, we knew, I claim, that this was correct, because this story came across the Dow Jones Newswire in early March of 2003. And Saudi Aramco and the government of Saudi Arabia told Western governments and the major oil companies that they were maxed out at 9.2 million barrels a day. And since that time, there have been two brief periods, 2 3-month periods, where the Saudi production went above 9 million barrels a day. Most months in the last 2 years, they've been under 9 million barrels a day. So it looks as if this is the equivalent story to the Texas Railroad Commission in 1972. Now, I carefully read my New York Times for the next 2 days, no mention of this story. So even though I'm a registered Democrat, I snuck out and bought the Wall Street Journal for 2 days, no mention. And the Wall Street Journal is Dow Jones. And here is the most important story since the Industrial Revolution. You know, Watt invents steam engine. World runs out of cheap oil. World runs out of cheap energy. And it didn't even make the newspaper. So there's a massive lack of attention being paid to this problem. Matt Simmons, who is a banker, he's head and founder of Simmons Co. International, the largest merchant bank in the oil industry. And Simmons was on a trip to Saudi Arabia. He said he almost didn't go, but finally he did. And as he's listening, he said, some of this doesn't add up. And he came home and discovered that he could download 200 technical papers that had been published over the years by Saudi Aramco engineers, and often they wouldn't even identify which oil field it was. Oh, but there are 37 wells in this field. Oh, that's the South Blankenship. You know, he sorted them out on his table into different oil fields and got help from petroleum engineers to interpret what all this meant. And he has a very reasoned, detailed analysis saying the Saudis are struggling to keep up. Now, this came out November 12, 2005, saying that Kuwait says the Bergan field, which is almost as big as the biggest field in Saudi Arabia, is now peaked out, and sorry, the 2 million barrels a day for the next 30 or 40 years, this isn't going to be there. They're peaking out at 1.7. So the word is going around, and even the major oil companies, you may have seen one of the Chevron ads that says, we're burning two barrels of oil for every barrel we find. ExxonMobil is saying that the last year when we found more oil than we burned was in the mid-1980s, and Shell Oil has announced, they're now Shell Gas, that they're going to forego the search for oil and become a natural gas search operation. They'll continue to run their tar sand mine producing oil in Canada, but they're basically kissing the oil business goodbye. So the major companies are acting as if they understand what's going on. Now, that's not universal. Here's Daniel Yergin, Cambridge Energy Research Associates, in a prediction about 6 months ago, and they took every announcement that an oil company or a national government had announced a project to do XYZ, and Yergin's people then said, oh, well, all these things will come in on time and under budget, and nobody will drill a dry hole, and their things plotted on my graph just suddenly take off into a faster than exponential growth. And sure, guys, nobody will drill a dry hole, and these things will all happen, you know, on time. And I don't believe it for a minute. Yergin's not a dummy, however. He sold out CERA to IHS company and pocketed the money and ran. Now, this is the gloomiest of all. Instead of talking about the year when the oil was produced, we're talking about the year of the first well in a field. And when you find that first well, you certainly are not going to stop drilling until you drill up the horizontal and vertical extent of the field. It's irreversible. You're not going to forget where the well was, and you're not going to forget to follow up. When I do that, the paucity of big hits lately brings me down almost to the bottom line, saying that the oil fields that we have now found contain 94% of all the oil we're ever going to find. Now, there's a lot of oil to be found by expanding existing fields. But as far as discoveries, it looks at, here's where the U.S. Geological Survey in the year 2000 published an estimate of 3 trillion barrels. And they did it by inventorying the whole world. And I can give another 90-minute lecture on the troubles with the USGS thing. But I'll point out briefly, they have to make up that gap between my 2 and their 3, they have to find another Middle East. Then they have to find another North Sea on top of it. And in the case of the United States estimate, they say that there's an undiscovered oil resource the size of Kuwait beneath the United States. And of course, I tease them by saying, hey, is that in South Alabama? You know, whisper in my ear. I'll split it with you. We'll all be rich. But it just doesn't exist. But a lot of estimates have been then produced by taking the USGS number as fact and then figuring out, oh, we won't have an oil peak until 2036 or sometime like that. Now, part of my trouble in talking about this is that every editor wants his writers to be fair, and that means tell both sides of the story. Well, when you tell both sides of the story, most of the readers will look at it and say, well, the experts don't agree, so there's no knowledge on this subject, so I won't do anything, which is an automatic win for the cornucopians, the ones who believe that there's going to be this wonderful, huge supply of oil, and we won't have a problem. So the cornucopians automatically win when people are fair. Editors, I think, are one of the great enemies of the people at this time. Now the new buzzword is redevelopment, going back to old oil fields, not for tertiary recovery, not for enhanced recovery, not trying to squeeze the last drop out of existing formations, but whole horizons that weren't produced in the early days. So it's probably a factor of 3 bigger than grassroots exploration. Now, everybody wants to know about price, and this is the price of natural gas in the United States, and this is first sale downstream from the well, first time that gas is traded for dollars, and the price at the Henry Hub spot market down in Louisiana, where a bunch of pipelines come together, is like this, only the swings are even bigger. And up through about 1987, the curve is very smooth. Then you start seeing wintertime peaks. Then 3 years ago, it goes crazy. And the most recent peak is twice as high as these. So what's going on? Well, the wife of one of my friends heard this lecture, and she said, oh, one of your equations is upside down. Well, it was right side up the way I was using it, but she knew it from queuing theory. And she had been a systems engineer with Bell Telephone Labs for 20 years, and the phone company knows about queuing. It's the customers waiting to use the long-distance circuits. But in queuing theory, she pointed out, the length of the queue, when the demands on the system approach the capacity of the system, the length of the queue becomes very volatile. And you know this from the grocery store or the bank or the airline check-in, that there's either nobody in line or a whole lot of people in line. And it's built in that if people are arriving at random, when the demands on the system approach the capacity of the system, we're going to see price volatility. And when people ask me, what's the price of oil, my first answer is, it's going to be very volatile. It's going to zoom up and down on you. And, of course, managers hate uncertainty. Matt Simmons made the interesting point that up until about 20 years ago, almost all natural gas was sold under long-term contracts. But now, without anybody discussing it, the price of oil and the price of natural gas are either the spot market or the shortest futures contract. And he says, look, if you could go back to signing a long-term contract, a 20-year contract, with a buyer who has a AA credit rating, he says, I can get you the money for that project at 4%. But if you want to have this price volatility show up in the rewards for making the investment, then the investor is going to want to see 15 or 20% cash flow rate of return in order to justify the exposure to that price volatility. So with a simple piece of paper, a long-term contract, producers and purchasers could eliminate that. Now, as this gets volatile, as things get difficult, as the general prices rise, there's some services that we know we need to have. And you can see the red cross. This is an ambulance, and we don't want this to happen. But we're going to have to reconfigure things and reprioritize things to arrange for a world where things make sense again. Now, my list of industries that are going to get hit are all crowded up at the top of the alphabet. Agriculture is very much at risk because the Green Revolution of 1970 was based on better seed varieties, heavy use of mineral fertilizer, and pesticides. Well, the pesticides are almost all petrochemicals. The mineral fertilizers are very heavy users of energy, and specifically the phosphate for fertilizer comes out of the ground as rock phosphate, same mineral that your teeth and bones are made of, and a lot of energy goes into converting that to water-soluble superphosphate that the plants can get at easily. The nitrogen fertilizer, what's nitrogen from the air? Isn't it free? Yeah, what do you react it with? Hydrogen. Where do you get the hydrogen? Natural gas. Uh-oh. Alan Greenspan has been telling us for a year and a half we're maxed out on natural gas in North America. In the automotive business, there were some nice options. 20 years ago, the natural gas-powered automobile was beginning to catch on, and there were natural gas civilian filling stations in New Zealand, Italy, and British Columbia. But then when the regulations changed in the United States and you could generate electric power with natural gas, suddenly that market got maxed out and the natural gas-powered automobile is not on the list. The brightest thing on the horizon for the automobile are these high-efficiency diesels being marketed in Europe that get more than 100 miles to the gallon, double what a gasoline-electric hybrid will get you. But they're not being sold in the United States, and I don't know why, but it's worth serious look. In the case of aviation, they don't have any alternatives. They're hooked on JP4 jet fuel and hooked very tightly, and aircraft manufacturers, passenger airlines, air freight, everything is going to be in a squeeze, and half the airline seats in the United States are now in bankruptcy. My brother first pointed this out when he read the first draft of Hubbard's Peak. He said, wait a minute, aviation is really going to be in trouble. And he was muttering, you know, I know a vice president of Boeing. I'm going to send him a copy of the book. Well, then, in this last year, when Boeing started taking away contracts from Airbus, because the Boeing 787 is going to have the lowest fuel consumption per seat mile of any airliner, they have been winning contracts away from Airbus. So I went back to my brother and said, hey, did you do that? And he says, oh, yeah, I don't want to take credit, but it's Caltech talk. I don't want to take credit, but I did send him a copy of the book, and I said, you better read this. You better memorize it. It's your future. So my brother and I claim we're the ones who bailed out Boeing. But the aircraft engine manufacturers are the bright spot that the efficiency, the compression ratio of these engines has gone up and up and up, and elderly 747s are flying nonstop New York to Hong Kong when they used to have to refuel, you know, in Minneapolis, Anchorage to get as far as Tokyo. Now, this is just a reminder when people say, well, what's going to happen to the price? All economists will decide that price is going to be the rationing, and the price will rise until supply again meets demand, and at that point there'll be a new steady equilibrium price. But this picture is a reminder that the Nixon administration fixed the price of oil. Now, William Safire of the New York Times writes funny cell phone interviews with Richard Nixon, who's serving a term in purgatory for fixing prices. If you're a Republican, see, that's a sin. And so what the Nixon administration invented, maybe inadvertently, was rationing by inconvenience. If you can remember the era, there were long lines of cars waiting for what little gasoline there was in the filling station. Then at an even earlier era, President Roosevelt had us running around with little red and blue ration coupons. So the answer is there will be rationing. But whether it's rationing by price, inconvenience, or coupons, or something else, we don't know. The sorts of things we could do next Monday morning, a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, and they will hate me in Montana, teaching the kids to turn out the lights, opening the house windows at night when it's cool at night to avoid using air conditioning during the day. There are some things that we can do right now. Then the next category is things that we know how to do, have the engineering done, and these are things like wind generation, nuclear, the high-efficiency diesel automobiles, where the engineering is done. We just need to get with it and start building. And then there are the blue sky things. Oh, the hydrogen-powered automobile or the, you know, something or other. But we need some R&D. We need to have an Apollo project or a Manhattan project, which might or might not work, in order to supply it. Well, one of my answers is, how about some old technology? And this is the city of Paris in 1870. And what the guy is delivering from the horse-drawn wagon is a mixture of hydrogen and carbon monoxide. Not high on your safety list right now, but it was used for illumination and for cooking. And you can see underneath the front of the top of the wagon across the street a gas light. And this gas was made by reacting coal with a limited amount of air and a lot of steam and producing what was variously called coal gas or town gas or water gas. The equivalent reaction today was re-engineered by Texaco engineers before Texaco got absorbed into Chevron, and they used pure oxygen, higher temperatures, better catalysts, better yield, and produced a what is now called a synthesis gas, because once you have that hydrogen, you could do lots of interesting things. Existing needs are petroleum refining and nitrogen fertilizer, but additional possibilities are you can make gasoline, and the Germans flew their Air Force during World War II with aviation gasoline made from soft brown coal. You can make methanol. And one of my friends has an enthusiasm for dimethyl ether. It's an almost ideal diesel fuel, and it doesn't make soot I had to look up the formula. It's a CH3 methyl group, an oxygen, another CH3 on the other side. There are no carbon-carbon bonds in that molecule. It can't make soot. You won't get black smoke out of a dimethyl ether diesel. And it's non-toxic, and I had to go to the drugstore and check it out, that the propellant in almost all hairspray today is dimethyl ether. It's non-toxic. You can be in a little bathroom spraying this stuff. You don't pass out. And it's made from coal, and it's a pilot plant running in China at the 10,000-gallon-a-day level. They're selling it for both cooking fuel and hoping to get the cost down to the range of $1 to $2 a gallon and sell it as diesel. And there's interest. Here's Volvo with DME for dimethyl ether on a diesel truck. This might be the thing of the future.
That was the first half of a one-hour lecture by Ken DeFace at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena in December 2005. He is Professor Emeritus at Princeton University. When working in the Shell Research Lab in Houston, he was a colleague of King Hubbard, who was the first person to predict a peak in oil production. DeFace is the author of two books, Hubbard's Peak and Beyond Oil. Come back for part two of his lecture when Ken DeFace talks about solutions. He says that major oil companies are now taking in tens of billions of dollars per company per quarter due to the high price of oil. These companies are not using the windfall for drilling, building of oil tankers, or refineries. They are, DeFace says, quite aware that oil is running out and these investments are no longer profitable. DeFace now wants oil companies to use their windfall on substitutes for oil. That's coming up in part two of the peak of world oil production. Ken DeFace was recorded by the LA Sound Posse at Caltech, Pasadena. You can find more information on Ken DeFace on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. You can get information how to order an audio copy of the complete 60-minute talk by Ken DeFace by calling us. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to get the audio tape or CD. You can place your order by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.